Right now, I'd like to invite the ushers to come forward. We're going to read our teaching text today, which is Matthew 6, verses 6. Matthew 6, verse 6. And you know what? I forgot to take a look at the page number, so can somebody holler that out? Once you find it. 894. Awesome. Matthew 6, verse 6. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everybody. You are here. Congrats, you're here. It's daylight savings time. What a weekend. It's Lent. That's exciting. Tonight we'll be at St. Cecilia's, as she said. The Michigan Wolverines are in the Big Ten final. Wow, half of you, more than we got for Lent. Today is March Madness Selection Sunday. That's a big deal. And Aaron Nyquist is in the house. So yeah, it's a good deal. We ready for this morning? Are we ready? Are we good? Are we here? We're here in body. Are we here in soul? Can we sort of like galvanize our souls and get ready for this? We're going to go on a bit of a ride, and I mean that metaphorically. A few years ago, I was teaching at a conference in Tulsa. Bronze Hands, anyone? Bronze Hands, Tulsa? No one been to Tulsa? You'll get it if you've been there. If not, we'll just move on. It was the second day, and I was waiting in the lobby for a friend of mine who was driving me back to the church where this conference was. And this lady approaches me and she says to me, excuse me, but I recognize you from the conference. And I was wondering if you would give me a lift this morning because my ride seems to have forgotten to pick me up. I said, sure. And she followed us to the car. That sounds really creepy. It's not creepy. She follows us to the car, and she couldn't have been a day under 60. Yet she had the spunk of a teenager. And so we start swapping stories about life on our way to church, and she suddenly stops and makes this confession out of nowhere. She says to me, up until a year ago, my faith was bankrupt for a decade. Again, she's got to be 60. And she says, up until a year ago, I went through an entire 10-year stretch where I felt like I was spiritually bankrupt. And she had been part of this long, robust history of a thriving church, one of the most notable churches of our lifetime. I mean, you hear the stories that we were swapping in the car, part of small groups, sang the songs, served faithfully, witnessed God doing incredible things over the course of life. But after several decades, her faith was bankrupt. Now, that doesn't mean that it was entirely without value. It means that we can come to a place, and she found that she had come to a place where she no longer could withdraw from the places that she had formerly withdrawn from and derived value. In other words, that the places she had drawn from and sought life, they had somehow dried up. They had ceased to produce, and she was longing for a deeper well. And so I asked her, I said, so what led you back to a place of flourishing? How did your faith recover from bankruptcy? And some of you are there this morning, where you feel like the things that you used to do or the things that sort of used to motivate you and get you excited and sort of galvanize your faith, that they've sort of like waned, and it seems like I'm still just sort of going through the motions, and where is the presence of God? And why do I feel distant, or why do I feel like I'm just not feeling anything anymore? And so I said, what led you back to flourishing? What brought you back from a place where you could recover from this kind of bankruptcy? And she says this. She says, what brought me back was the ancient practices of the church. It was there when I began to apply my faith. She said, I suddenly learned how to pray. That I had been sitting in church my whole life. I even helped plant one. And yet it wasn't until I went through this stretch of bankruptcy that God was speaking life into me to find something from the past that can reorient a life toward the future. And so we parked the car and we entered the auditorium. And as we shook hands, I realized I did not even know her name. So I said, "It was so good to meet you. My name is AJ." And she says, "It was good to meet you too. My name's Lynn Hybels." Some of you know that name. Erin Nyquist definitely knows that name. Some of you know that name. I think she's one of the great advocates for peace in our time. So let's begin with a question on this second Sunday in Lent. Would you say that you have grown in prayer in the last year of your life? Simple question. Don't overcomplicate it. Another way to say it is, has your pursuit of God increased? Like, when you think about the last year, what has that been like for you? Again, let me remind you of something that I said last week. Lent is not a season of self-condemnation. Lent is a season of self-evaluation. It's not a season where you heap shame upon yourself because you're not this far, you haven't done these things, or you've not sort of moved in these sort of angles of the faith. That's not what it is, so don't read it for what that is. That's not true. What Lent is a time of slowing, where you can begin to evaluate, how am I really doing? Are the things I'm doing producing fruit? So let me begin with this phrase that I think best describes what I'm hoping to say in these brief moments today, and I'll put it on the screen. It's this: every moment of every day, the most significant reality in the entire universe is the radical availability of God's presence. And yet, every moment of every day, we remain unaware of this generous gift. What if that's true? What if that's sort of like the elephant in every single room that we walk in, that we just don't really take time to pay attention to? Let me define the crisis for us here this morning. Prayer is not one of many functions in our relationship with God. Prayer is our relationship with God. And that's really humbling. That prayer isn't like a facet that I got all these other things, and if I can get to prayer, then that's really great, and it's sort of a bonus on top. Prayer is our relationship with God. I had this mentor several years ago he and his wife, they led these retreat breakthroughs for couples. And Elaine and I had just gotten married, and he started mentoring me, and he invited me into this retreat he was doing, and I'll never forget him saying a phrase that blew my mind about my marriage. And it's one of those phrases that at first it doesn't really make a lot of sense, but then over time, if you sit with it, it starts to do its work on you, and it starts to get in you. You start to consider, like, whoa, I think this has like deeper meanings than just like a literal meaning. And he says this. He says, "You are not in a marriage having conversation. The conversation you are having or not having is your marriage." And it sort of like was like, what does that even mean? And I sit with it over time, and what it means is this: that when we think about marriage, I'm using like a human relationship to say something much broader that we'll get to in a second. The conversation is the marriage. The conversation with your spouse, for those that are married, that is your marriage. And so I said, wait, Doug, are you telling me that real, vulnerable, authentic conversations with my spouse, the pursuit of my spouse, is the substance of my marriage? And he said, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. The conversation you are having or avoiding with Elena, AJ, reveals the depth of your marriage. And it's the same with God. That the conversation you are in, or the conversation you are avoiding, or the conversation you are neglecting with God is your relationship with God. It's not like I go to church and I do this small group thing and I have all these other programs. That's not it. That is just, all that is a trellis that a vine is supposed to grow on called life. What is the substance of our spirituality is the conversation we are in or not in with God. Let me back up just for a second. Hang with me. We're talking about prayer here, okay? We're talking about prayer. You realize we're talking about conversations, we're talking about intimacy, we're talking about pursuing God in a relational dynamic. You do realize that God spoke the world into existence. However that means, whatever that looked like, God spoke. In other words, God said, let there be light. And it happened that we are here because God had a conversation with God. Now let's get crazy. Let's get March Madness crazy. Let's go to John 1:1. Check this out. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made, and without him nothing was made that has been made. Now you've all heard this before, at least most of you have, right? So this old Dutch guy comes along. Anyone Dutch here, by the way? Just throwing that out. This old Dutch guy comes along. On off chance, there might be someone Dutch here, right? In the 16th century, his name is Desiderius Erasmus. And he says this. He goes, I wonder if word in John 1 means that Trinity has been in a dialogue. And if Trinity has been in a conversation, if Trinity has been in sort of a dialogue, a relational dynamic, and out of that God spoke the word into existence and something came to be, I wonder if it might be true to translate John 1:1 like this. In the beginning was the conversation, and the conversation was with God, and the conversation was God. That what if prayer is you simply joining a conversation? What if that's what prayer is? Or at least what if that is one of the dynamics of prayer? Rather than you creating all these new conversations with God, what if there's a conversation to join? What if there's a conversation that's been going on ever since the beginning of time? So let's go back to where we started. Prayer is not one of many functions of your relationship with God. Prayer is your relationship with God. And if you're anything like me, that makes me feel humbled. Because I think the elephant in every single church auditorium is that we're all pretty sort of bad at it. So there's no condemnation to be found in this room. There's just evaluation of saying, I wonder if that's true for me, and I wonder what this year might look like, and I wonder what Lent might mean if I were to check in to a deeper well, to a deeper conversation, to create space to be with God. There's all sorts of different forms of prayer. We know that. There's prayer requests, there's intercession, there's prophecy, there's thanksgiving, there's singing, and those are all really good things. But I noticed that many of us, if you're like me, we grew up in contexts in churches or hearing about churches where praying always was about doing something. It was always about speaking something. And when we run out of things to say, what it means is this. It means the conversation's over. When I'm done sort of launching my to-do list toward God, then I'm sort of get on with my day and prayer is done. God bless this. God help me with that. God fix this. God thanks for that. And it's over and now I can get on with my day. And this morning I want to talk briefly about a neglected form of prayer that I stumbled into that began increasing my intimacy with God several years ago. And this form of prayer, I think, is what Lynn Hybels was getting at back in Tulsa. And it's two words. It's the words noise, and it's the word room. For the next 3 weeks, we're just going to use 6 words total, 2 each week, to sort of take us deeper and deeper into understanding what does it mean to join a conversation. So let's begin with noise. Let's start with the external noise. We all sort of get that, right? This idea of noise that's coming at us all the time, sort of recruiting our affections, always vying for our attention, right? Whether it's the sounds or the snow trucks or the sirens or the cell phones, we have this weird, odd relationship with noise. We hate noise, yet we love noise. We hate the advertisements, but we love them all. We disdain the crowds, but we love the movement. And it's deafening, all of the noise all the time. But there's this other source of noise too, not just the external noise, that I think is equally as deafening, and it's the internal noise that I really want to spend a couple minutes with here. It's the constant mental chatter that's always swirling about in our heads, which brings us to St. Hesychius, right? St. Hesychius, what a great icon. I love gray beards. I think gray beards give great pastoral credibility, and I pray for a gray beard. Another thing that gives pastoral credibility is a bald head, which is why Troy Hatfield is our resident sage at Mars Hill, right? This idea of Saint Hezekiah, he comes along and he says, I think the interior mind, the sort of prayer, the chatter, all of this noise happening all the time, it's like this donkey tethered to a mill going round and round and round, and we can't seem to get off it. That even when you can silence the external noise, even when you're that sort of skilled to shut out all the sounds around you, what you're left is a deafening monologue happening in your head. And that monologue doesn't just happen in a vacuum. That monologue happens because there are these three chief triggers that I think that are underneath it all. And they go by three words that all begin with the letter C, coincidentally. Words like competence and comparison and control, that I think swirling underneath a lot of the ways that we can't get out of our heads, these three dynamics are somewhere at work, that when I'm still enough, it's embarrassing as a confessional just how insecure I am about my competency. I mean, I'm so insecure about my teaching gift. I'm insecure I don't know enough. I'm insecure I'm not wise enough, that I'm not a good communicator, that I fumble over words, that I don't know how to actually land the plane, all of these things. And maybe you too obsess with questions like, am I good enough? Am I talented at anything? And around it goes. Does life really matter with me in it? And around it goes. Through our social media, we then look at our comparison with others, right? Or other ways that we compare, and we think, are they better than me? Is my life as interesting as theirs? Because they seem to be very interesting, and I feel rather bland. Or we think about things like, move into questions of control, and we think, like, is my future secure? Or are they the right person for me? And why can't I just be happy like other people seem to be? And around the conversation swirl, and the noise just keeps on coming all the time. Can anyone relate? Can I get a witness? Yeah? I had a friend one time who said to me, we were talking about this, and he said, are you having a conversation, or is a conversation having you? That was really helpful. To realize that I'm not actually in control of this conversation. This conversation seems to be in control of me. And it seems like every time I get quiet enough, I'm in this same conversation, this same stress, this same anxiety, this same relationship that's going south, this same debacle that's happening at work, this same thing happening in my family, this same thing with my kids, that I just can't seem to get out of the mental conversation. That there are conversations we are always in with ourselves, and no one knows about it. It's always happening. And like the donkey, you can't get out of the mill. And here's what Jesus in the wilderness, we looked at this passage last week in Luke 4, you see it in Matthew 4 as well. Here's what Jesus is doing. When he goes to the wilderness, what we find is this. I think this is the big revelation of Jesus moving into the wilderness away from the crowds. I think what Jesus is modeling out is this, that your core identity and my core identity is never discovered within the noise. You can figure out who you are in the noise or who you're not, but we never discover who we are in the midst of all the noise. I think this is why Jesus is always leaving the crowds all the time. You see him like, whoa, man, this is like your moment for influence. And he's like, peace, I gotta go. All the time. Because I think noise rarely brings clarity. It's in the quiet where we remember who we are. I was struck by this painting. I think it's 19th century. It's Ivan Kramskoy, the Russian artist. He painted this. And I think it's just one of those beautiful moments where an artist depicts the person of Jesus inaccurately so, and yet there's just something to this piece when I first came about it years ago that led me to think, what kind of conversation is Jesus in right now? What kind of being is happening in him? What kind of identity is he being reminded of as he moves into ministry? One of my good friends here at Mars Hill, he left his job a few months ago. He felt called to leave his job, and he couldn't find one. And He had a lot of time on his hands. And so he sat and he prayed and he read and he struggled and he wrestled in silence for months, thinking like this would be like a quick thing and I'm going to leave this thing and something will pop up and I just feel called to it and God's led me into this. And so, and then he found himself in a kind of wilderness and he's struggling. And this past week, he got these two offers from jobs out of nowhere, like for months, silence. And then all of a sudden, boom, it all just sort of came together. And he's like, was reflecting with me about this reality. And he said that he often felt like this sort of struggle with silence has led him to wrestle with who he is and who he's not more than ever before. And then he crystallized his sort of season of dryness of wilderness that some of you might even find yourselves in today. And he said this, he said, that's the thing about the desert. He said, you have to be honest about who you are in the desert because you have nothing to cling to. It's scary, but at least you know what you're really about. And for those of us who feel like you're in some sort of wilderness right now, wilderness feels like a curse. But in the rearview mirror, what we find is that wilderness is a gift. Because it's often in that season where we will discover who we really are and whose we really are. The second word is room. Room. So Jesus spends these 40 days in the wilderness, and he comes off and he says this in the Sermon on the Mount. This is the first sort of words that he utters after his 40 days spent in silence and in temptation. He says, but you, when you pray... I love the when there, the assumption of the conversation. Not if, but when. And that's what disciples do. They're in conversation. Go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who's in secret. This word room in the Greek, it's this word timion, and it refers to this sort of place where you can meet with God alone. I think like noise, there's two directions to it. The first is external. It's this idea of geography that Jesus was talking about this room. To hear this like in plain language, the literal sense, is like Jesus saying, okay, great, find a room, go there, and like do something, like be with God, say some things, and hear some things. In the first century, dwellings, like houses in that time, they were constructed with rooms that had all this shared space. Like the idea of like privacy in a dwelling was something that was so rare that only few could actually afford it. It was a luxury that so few people had access to their own rooms and places. So you all sort of like lived together in certain places. And so many believe that Jesus is referring to this kitchen-like pantry that was in the center. If you've ever been to Israel and you've seen the way that sort of rooms are sort of cut out, and if you've been to Capernaum, you can see how they kind of form together and then they kind of cluster and these families live near one another. And in the center, you had this kitchen-like pantry. And this is a room that's in the center of a dwelling and there's no windows and they would often store dry goods. And it was a place that kept a little bit cooler than everywhere else, right? This was the day before Frigidaire. And so you could keep goods there that you wanted to preserve. And so praying in that space, because there's no windows, it would ensure privacy, it would ensure sincerity. No one's looking in from the outside. But I think that there's something more here than just geography. I don't think Jesus is just saying, hey, go to that pantry that you know about and spend some time with God there. I think that Jesus is speaking also at the same time at a deeper level. And I think he's saying, when he says to you and to me and to the disciples, go into your room, I think there's an internal dimension that he's talking about. And I think this is what's so key for us this morning. I think what Jesus is saying is that there is an internal room in your being. And I don't just long for you to pray from the surface. I don't just want you to pray from the exterior of yourself about just all the things that, God, give me this and hope for that and bless this and go with me there. I think that those are fine prayers, but I think Jesus is saying that there comes a time in prayer where we're called to move beneath our surface level selves, where Jesus is calling us to go deep within and to access how we really feel and what we really think and what we truly believe and the lives we really want to live, and to then pray from the deepest part of ourselves, that we would pray from that place of honesty, That place of awareness, that place of a vulnerability, I think it explains why when Jesus says, pray anything in my name and you will receive it, because he's assuming that we're praying from that place of depth. Not that place of just like springing off prayers in the middle of our day, but actually giving ourselves time and intention and quiet and going not just geographically into an inner room, but existentially into the deepest part of who you are and saying, God, this is how it feels. This is what I think is true. This is where I'm really wrestling. Here is where I'm sensing lack. Would you show up in these places? Would I feel your embrace? I think this is the depths of the soul where the image of God is imprinted. And for all who call upon the name of Christ, we open ourselves in such a way that it invites the invasion of the Holy Spirit to come deep within our lives, that God receives our invitation to come within us and dwells in the core of who we are. And this kind of prayer has a name, and it's the word contemplation. And it's not just getting clear with yourself. It's not just mindfulness. It's not just like feeling your feet on the floor and saying, here I am with me. It's to say, here I am, and God has been here all along, and I long for that connection, that spark. If we had to define contemplative prayer, it's simply this. It's the practice of stilling ourselves before God, moving ever deeper into the core of our being, and simply offering ourselves to God in totally vulnerable love. Let me read that again. This kind of prayer that I'm talking about, which is one kind of prayer, it's not the only kind, but it is the practice of stilling ourselves before God, moving ever deeply into the core of our being, and simply offering ourselves to God in totally vulnerable love. And what I've found over the years of trying this on isn't that I show up in totally vulnerable love and then God meets me. It's that God has been the one who's been there all along and is just longing for me to show up. And I've just been too busy to notice. So over the next two Sundays, what we're going to do is we're just going to take a bit of a deep dive into this form of prayer. It's a form of prayer that prioritizes being over doing. And here's my assumption. My assumption is that you're really good at the doing part. You're really good at making requests. You're really good at reading and praying what's going on in your life. I think that's good. I think we should affirm that. But that there's also patterns of deeper still where we can be and we can know we're loved and we can live from that place. Because maybe you've yet to cultivate a deep prayer life that truly satisfies. Maybe this is the year. Maybe like Lynn, and like me, you found yourself in a place in your life where you're sort of teetering on a kind of spiritual bankruptcy, and it's just time to try something new. It's time to try something on. It's time to maybe go someplace a little deeper. And so I'm going to ask Aaron, I don't know if he's here, where's Aaron? I'm just going to ask him to underscore for a moment. Tonight at St. Cecilia, at the music hall there, we're going to be upstairs focusing on an ancient form of prayer called the Jesus Prayer. The Jesus Prayer is the most utilized prayer in church history, and it's probably the most unrecognized prayer in the Western church. It's the most utilized prayer in all of church history. And for most people in the West, most Christians, they say, I've never heard of it. What is that? Tonight, we're going to focus on that. I'm going to share a little bit about what that is, and we're going to connect with those who have gone before us and pray a simple prayer that we can walk with and that we can live through. It's kind of like a lens, a filter that we can see all of life. And so if that's you and you'd like to join us, we will be there at 5. There's a few tickets left. And we'll spend an hour there doing that. And what I want to do as we close, I just want to throw this piece of art back up. For those of you that like visual, if you don't like visual, you'd rather just close your eyes, feel free to do that. We're going to take just 2 minutes before Christine comes and leads us in communion. And we're just going to pause. Lent means slowly. So let's go slowly. And let's take 2 minutes and be still. Aaron's just going to play underneath us. And if you would love to just gaze into that painting and just say, God, what do you want to say to me? Or maybe, God, you don't want to say it. You just want to remind me that you're here. Close how we started. Every moment of every day, the most significant reality in the entire universe is the radical availability of God's presence. Yet in almost every moment of every day, we remain unaware of this generous gift.